we're not, we're just, you can public hear with one. Yeah.
Okay.
Gosh, I can't learn some things with you anymore.
House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Public hear with.
We can't open our work session yet because our members are not here, but so we will stand at ease. So much for my. The committee will come back to order and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2543. Would you go ahead and give us a quick intro and then we'll bring up the department and some other people and we'll get started with the conversation. Let me just start by saying, colleagues, we've been working on a work group, Representative Berger and I, with a number of other people involved. And we have some things we'd like to discuss this morning with the committee to sort of get a sense of where you are, and then that will help us as we continue to get this done. And I'll just do the intro myself. The point of all this is to see what we can do to manage the program for property taxes, deferred property taxes for seniors, given that our fund has been entirely depleted. There are some sideboard issues that we want to talk about today, and we need to figure out how we're going to finance the issue in the future. So, yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, if committee members, your co-chairs have been meeting with staff and experts in a number of evening meetings to get us to this point. We feel at this point the need of bringing in a bigger conversation. What we're looking for today is for you to understand the direction we're going, to give us guidance on where you would like to go or where you think we are not thinking about or not going. This program, one of the interesting things is that we are not alone in this. Other states are having exactly the same problem. Some have just gotten rid of this program because it's unfunded. So this is a product of our economy and our housing situation. We are, I think, sincerely engaged in trying to save our program in Oregon because we think it has great value. So to that end is what we are going through this circumstance. There's no money in it now. We think if we get the right sideboards and get it recapitalized, it can go forward.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead and please, members, chime in when we get to an issue that you would like to talk about further, but we're going to go through 13 points and then have a conversation about those and anything else that's related to the bill. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, Chair Berger, members of the committee. The first change that would be proposed would be an asset check for people initially as they enter the program. We looked at some limits in other states. It could be about $75,000 in assets in North Dakota, ranging up to $500,000 in assets in Maryland. There are some very specific criteria in Maryland provided on their website that define exactly what could be constituted as assets. And so that might be helpful as a guide.
And that's at the very bottom of the second page.
Yeah, the footnote
on the
one.
Back, put the footnote on the back. Sort of describes that.
Could I mention something
please,
quickly before
yes.
she? Because one of the things that isn't on this sheet, but which was a baseline thing that we started with when we began, which is the current sideboard, which is in order to get into this program, you have to have a retained index $39,500 household income limit and 62 years of age limit. We started without changing that. Okay, we started with that is the existing. Now, that $39,500 household income is an indexed amount. It changes mm-hmm. with the economy. But the 62-8, I mean, that was a base assumption that we could have changed, but we chose not to, and then went through a series of things. If we did this, what would happen? And that's what Christine is going through, is the if-thens that we have gone through.
And Madam Chair, is it worth at some point you might share with us your thinking on that, or did you at a subsequent time talk about what would change or what how would the finances change if that assumption about the age were changed?
We really didn't. It was one that we could have. We wanted to work through these others first. One of the things we're trying hard to kind of get to is if you're in the program and these you went in under these assumptions, how many can you change before you've changed the...
It's a good point, Madam Chair, but going forward, perhaps.
It is certainly on the table, and that's why I bring it up now, because you won't find it in this list, but it was one of the baseline things we started with, and we certainly could go back and rethink that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In change number one on the asset test, does that asset test include the home itself, or does that exclude the property?
If you look at the back of the same sheet of paper, you can see Maryland's test, and what it essentially is it excludes the house itself. We'd consider that in a different place, but it does include all financial assets and other real property, except the cash value of insurance policies, and it excludes tangible personal property, so your couch and your easy chair are not included in their definition. We can do it any way we want, but now, my suspicion, I don't know this, but my suspicion is that some of the states with much smaller limits actually have a more narrow definition of what the assets are that they count. I don't know that, but that's...
So it's not necessarily apples to apples, even between the 150
right.
and the 75, 240, those are all
right.
whole new novels.
Every state treats this a little differently
and,
as well.
Yes, and the issue that got us here... was that other than the income test, the $39,500 test, there was no asset test at all
in Oregon,
and it seemed at least to some of us that it didn't make sense that somebody whose income happened to be short this year, but who had lots of financial assets, ought to have their taxes deferred by this mechanism, when they actually have the money to pay for them themselves. Even though they may actually not have much income this year, they have assets that would allow them to make those payments. That was the theory. And, of course, also, we're trying to figure out how to narrow this thing down so that it does become more affordable. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the question about the foundational question, 62 years of age and 39.5, how long ago were those numbers established?
Should we bring John up?
Does the department know? Why don't you two come up and...
Then you, these are...
We'll just put you there, and you can engage in the conversation with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips, the Department of Revenue. We would have to check that number. We think it was probably from the inception of the program, back probably 69 or before.
So it's 50 years.
Follow-up? Thank you. And then this number may be in the materials. I just have forgot it. But the anticipated increase in the number of folks over 62, is there a percentage or some other number you can say this number is going to increase each year by, and fill in the blank, 5%, 2%? In other words, demographic is aging. And I looked at some of these numbers the other day. It didn't look like it was that. Actually, it was big. But how many more people will be added to the program each year? Yeah, I'm asking how many more 62-year-olds are going to be in Oregon each year is my question.
My name is Bromex, Rand, Department of Revenue. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, we don't anticipate a significant increase in the number of program participants going forward. It seems to have leveled off, and we have not seen an increase in any specific demographic going forward. Program participation seems to increase more with the economy tied to indexes that would gauge how well the economy is generally doing. When we have an economic downturn, it seems like all segments of the population right now have increased.
This program applies also to disabled and senior. And so it isn't just the senior population that's moving this. And remember, the goal is to keep folks who... And we need to preamble this. The goal of this program, in my mind, is to keep folks from going into institutional care or more expensive care when a little help in the property tax mm-hmm. could keep them in a home they have lived in a long time. And it's designed around the elderly and the fragile who don't move well and who can do very well in their situation and won't have to be. I mean, the public benefit is that they won't have to go into more expensive, move in with their daughters and their three kids or have to go into some sort of more expensive institutional care. If we can give them a little help on this ongoing expense, the payoff for us is, of course, that when the house is sold, we get our money back.
Right. That's the key.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative,
thank you, Co-Chair Berger. That, you know, because when I was looking at these things, that policy is what I really wanted to try to keep in mind. You know, what's the main goal? What are we trying to accomplish? Will any of these changes prevent us from being able to accomplish that? So
yes, and in thinking about that, the reason that this, I think that I want to save it, and I don't want to speak for my co-chair here, is that the public benefit of keeping people in their homes is great, and as long as we get our money back, our risk is minimal. But all of a sudden, this housing market dropped, and we either have to stop the program in its tracks, which states have done, or figure out a way to go forward so that the public is assured that eventually, over time, the property taxes will come back to the states and the counties and through the regular system. That's the way it's supposed to work. But it's a time function, and the public benefit has to be kept in mind. And
a quick follow-up on that same subject matter. So just so that we're not retreading the same ground, when these funds were swept, was there a plan or a thought process that was discussed? I wasn't here, so that's why I'm asking the question. Was there a thought process or a plan that was discussed for replacing the money that was taken? And is that the starting point?
I wasn't here either.
Is that the starting point that we should be beginning
at? Well, you're referring to the sweeps that took place in early 2003 and then in the last couple of biennia. I can tell you that I was not in the places where that conversation could have taken place in the Ways and Means process. I didn't hear anything that would suggest that was happening. It was more a matter of there's some money here, we can take it. and it's connected with seniors in some way, so we can spend it on OPI instead. I will tell you that I was pretty vocal in objecting to that plan for precisely the reasons that we now find ourselves having this discussion. It didn't seem to affect any decision-makers' minds at all, at least so far as I can tell. I'm not aware of any agreements on anybody's part. Of course, they'd be completely non-binding anyway, but on anybody's part to actually replace the money. It was a place that they could get funds and deal with it. Now, from my point of view, you've raised an interesting thought. One of the possibilities is to go back to the Ways and Means Committee and basically say, look, the general fund owes this fund this money because it was taken and spent in earlier years. I will tell you, and you already know this, that because of the budget problem that we face generally, that particular argument is not likely to hold a whole lot of weight, even though I might make it anyway.
Yeah, well, and I didn't ask the question to beat anybody up.
No, I know you did, but I'd like to beat them up.
Right, and there'll be plenty of time for that, to be sure. But, I mean, I honestly ask the question because I think that, you know, when people make these decisions, if they have something in mind, that's a good starting spot.
Unfortunately, I don't believe that was the case.
Thank you, Representative
Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I'm clear on the summary, it states that the taxes accumulate as a lien against the tax-deferred property, and there was some question in our last discussion about whether indeed we did have a lien and where that lien fit on a priority scale. But before we begin to answer that question, it would be interesting to compare this device that we're talking about today to what would happen without it and the comparable rates of taxes you don't pay, because they of course accumulate as a lien against your property and eventually you can be foreclosed out. But that process generally takes around 7 years, if I recall correctly, and the differential appears to be the amount of interest that accrues as one waits. And having been through that a couple of times, I'm just curious if you could state, first of all, where we are on a lien priority basis under the device we're discussing today, and then maybe a little comparison to what would happen if we didn't have the device.
Sure. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, our lien is a lien the same as other lenders' mortgage company liens, and our ability to collect on that lien depends upon the priority of the lien. If we are in first position, second position, which lien is senior determines our ability to collect those funds.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, if I might add, I would distinguish it from a tax lien. It's not a tax lien because we have paid the taxes, and so it's just a lien on the loan. So,
follow up.
Yeah, please.
You mean it's a lien that is behind the mortgage on the house and behind? It's not superior to. It's not doesn't have priority over. In the general state, you come in behind whoever was there when you paid off the taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct. So if they have a mortgage on the property and then they enter the deferral program, the mortgage is first, we're next. Then if they get an equity loan after that, that would follow our lien and so on. And you had a second question.
My question was, when this was put together, why didn't it provide for a substitution so that when those taxes were paid, the state stayed right where the tax lien would have been or was before they were paid off? Why wasn't there simply a simple substitution worked so the state remained prior to everybody else? Because that's indeed where it was before it paid off those taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I don't know what the thinking was at the time. There's not been involved in any conversations about why and what the rationale was for that. We have talked, though, subsequent, when this whole discussion came up, we started talking, I think, earlier on about increasing the level of the lien, and we had some feedback directly from several mortgage companies that said they want to be in on that conversation.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, this brings us to my second question, which is, if we didn't have the program and just let those taxes accrue, the interest on those unpaid taxes, was it 16%? Forgotten the interest on those unpaid taxes.
Yes, it is.
And then if you move to foreclosure, the interest actually drops down to the statutory rate from 16% to something else. Am I right there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's absolutely correct. Once the county takes judgment and decree, which is, I think, in the fifth year or so, the rate drops to 9%.
On the amount of the judgment?
On the amount of the outstanding taxes, too.
Oh,
yes.
Even new taxes that accrue?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you want to follow on this specific line of questioning?
What I think we might want to do is go through the list, and we may answer some of the questions that people have. If you have something that's sort of preliminary,
I will hold off on some of those.
No, go ahead.
And kind of borrowing from other tax policies in different arenas and making some comments or its notes down. But we mentioned the starting point of $39,500 of income. What is the definition of that income? What's included in that income?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Air Brewer, the initial year, there's two tests. The initial year, it's household income. And included in that is something Brom can talk about, but it's much broader. Tends to be income from people in the household, not just a single person who's the applicant necessarily. Every subsequent year, following the initial year, it's federally adjusted gross income. That's the test.
Really?
Yes.
There's changes proposed.
And if you'll look at item two, you'll see that we're talking about that issue directly.
Okay, but does number two talk about the initial qualifying year?
Yeah, that's why I think it might make sense to go through the list and then come back to these questions if we didn't answer
what we didn't get
Interestingly, Representative Bentz raised an issue we hadn't talked about, but there may be a lot of other questions that come up with issues that we did talk about, and I think it might be useful to go through those first and then come back to those questions.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
And as we said, item two would change that subsequent test that happens every 2 years from a federally adjusted gross income test to a household income test, which is broader in the types of income that it could cover and would probably result in disqualification of a few more participants on that basis if their income goes up over time. There is a positive revenue impact to that, but it's quite uncertain because you would have to model how people's incomes would change over time in order to come up with that.
If I could, the thinking here is that we have had an initial income test, but then we haven't come back and retested. And so the notion is that basically you would reapply every 2 years with the full test. Rather than and how that test would look, we didn't get into the weeds of. But rather than just you apply once and then we just check your AGI, it would be you literally reapply with all of the initial information coming back in.
Yeah.
Thank you. I am all for moving away from AGI, whether initially or in subsequent recertifications, because AGI is not indicative of income. It's only indicative of taxable income, and which is not really has anything to do with the ability to pay property taxes. So I'm there, but I would think quite a bit of work would need to be done to define household, for which household income is included. And then when we look at the population making up the income, so if it's whatever makes up that household, but then looking at what is in the income and what is included in the income, and that we're going to be very clear, because whenever you talk about income, it's very discretionary, but we can set those definitions.
Is there a definition currently in the statute for household income for that initial test that we already have?
Mr. Chair, what we've been using for household income, we have extracted from the IRS publication, I believe it's 17 and a half, which defines income sources, whether they're taxable or not. Household income, our test is designed to capture pretty much all sources of income. There are very few income sources that are excluded from the household income test.
That talks about what types of income are included. It doesn't talk about who's in the household. Household income, because we have great family dynamics changing, and we might have someone who's part year at the home. We might have someone who's there temporarily, permanently. We might have four families living in any one home. And so we need to really look at what is household income when we define household. And that is... We can define it, but we really have to look at that in current family definitions.
Mm-hmm. We might take a look and see what definitions exist in other arenas that are similar.
Yeah.
To see about that. Why don't we go ahead to the next item, and you'll have a comment about that one, I think.
Items 3 and 4. Item 3 is a requirement that new applicants be in their homes for 3 or 5 years before participating, and that would reduce the level of some new applications. And number 4 would be also to apply a real market value
test.
But
you're on the wrong page. Oh, hi. Yesterday's notes, and you're right.
Use the new one.
There it is. Thank you.
A little too early for you there, Madam Clifford.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking from last night's notes.
She renumbered.
I moved it up on the list because of its revenue impacts, which the cap of median county RMV would drop the participation rate by 4,000 of the 11,800 participants. Just to give you an example, and the median county real market values are here.
Yeah,
this
you just got them passed out to you in this little handout with the two columns on it. This shows you the county median real market value for residences. I know you did that in a hurry this morning. We appreciate your getting it to us.
Certainly.
And you can see how much they would vary by counties. Gilliam County has a real market value of $77,204. And Clackamas County is the highest at $262,303. So it would be important to evaluate the participation relative to the real market value in the county itself. And there is an idea that we would allow more real market value for additional years in the home. So there might be a schedule of how long people have been in their home, and allowing a little bit more in real market value all the way up to possibly 2 times the median real market value if someone has been in their home for a long time, maybe 15 or 30 years.
And getting to the policy question that Representative Wand raised, one of the things we know from the study of aging is that if a couple or an individual has lived in a home for a long, long time, moving them when they're older may have significantly negative health consequences. On the other hand, if they've only been there a short while or they've moved a number of times, they're likely to be more flexible. And so part of the reason for increasing the eligibility in terms of the dollar value of the home would be to account for that. The other purpose, of course, is that the values may have grown enormously in the 30 years that they've lived there without any intervention on their part at all. It's simply a function of the markets. So that was our thinking. Now, of course, the committee may have a completely different set of ideas about that. Then I'd like to comment a bit about why we got to the new applications have to be 3 or 5 years, and my thought about that, and I'd like your comment about the history of the recent events concerning foreclosures. My thought was that it was important that this program not be included in the initial decision on the part of an older couple for financing purposes, for buying a new place.
Right.
Could you tell us about the foreclosures that you described to us at our meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What we've noticed through the program, we have recently encountered a number of properties that we have had to go through procedures on, where we've had to write off significant balances, around $100,000, from program participants who joined the deferral program in the very same year they purchased their new residence. And one of the concerns that was brought up is that they are considering the deferral program, making their tax payments in part of their financing plan for the property. Then the resulting margins on their property are so slim that oftentimes they get into some sort of distress in subsequent years and end up losing their home.
Thank you. So that was the sort of the thinking there. Representative Brewer?
Thank you. When I saw this, this is something that's used in tax policy many times, and that's to diffuse motivations that don't achieve the policy, and I would actually concur with that, but I would like to add something to this, not another policy perspective, though, I like 3 or 5 years, whatever we decide on that for the initial qualification, but also to we have in the income tax code and residency of selling of a home, there's a concept in there that it allows for folks that, you know, they have to live in this home 2 out of the last 5 years, blah, 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 for a certain income provision. But what it does allow, and it makes sense, that someone can actually leave their home to go into an assisted living care for 1 year or less and still have that year count as a year of residency. I think we need to not only have them be in their home prior to qualifying for a certain number of years, they have to be in their home, but I think they have to maintain living in their home, and I know that that may not make sense, but we also should provide a short-term leaving of their home if it's for a bona fide temporary residency in a care facility of some sort. As they age, they may get displaced, but they need a place to come back to.
There may be a medical reason for that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
How does it work now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Aaron Brewer, there already is a provision for that in current law and rule, yes.
And do you know the duration of time they're allowed to be out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Aaron Brewer, as long as we have a note from a medical provider, there is no time limit on their allowed absence.
We need to change that. I would suggest that would be something that we can change,
yeah.
Because that does allow the rest of the household to maintain living there. You know, and it allows a deviation from a policy, I think.
Do you have a suggested duration?
I'm not a medical expert, and I'm not sure in seniors what is a normal temporary stay. Is that 1, 2 years, three years to me starts to sound really long.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know. It could be, you know, 12 months, 24.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one of the benefits we have in Oregon, we have the shortest length of stay in nursing homes and assisted living facilities in the nation, less than 30 days per stay. So we don't have a lot of incentives in Oregon for people to be in institutional care. I think it would be unusual that someone would be in a nursing home in Oregon for 2 years or 3 years or...
Well, but of course, someone who's not coming back might very well get a note from the doctor that satisfies the tax man.
Mm-hmm. But they may also have a spouse that also is over the age of 62 that is still living
in which case,
home.
Of course, that
they
person
would
be the qualifying
okay.
person.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that's an area we can work on.
Yeah. But you'd never get to this question if there was a spouse living in the home who was the
over qualifying.
The qualifying age
okay.
income, right? I think. Isn't that right? If one member of the household is in the assisted living, but the other member is still living in the home and is qualified, you wouldn't even get into this discussion, would you?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Representative Berger.
Committee members, this point 4 is where the big savings is, but you will notice that it drops 4,000 people out of a 10,400 populated. Which I think is untenable until we have a better idea of who those 4,000 are, which we don't at this point. We are trying to determine what the effects of that is. But this is the substantive change that really recapitalizes, if you will, this whole program. And we've not had this kind of a test before, so it's a very significant change.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair. I have an initial thought on this in response. At first, I didn't like this test at all, and then I started thinking about it as you were discussing it up here. There is some merit to the real market value increasing and allowing an you know, a higher percentage than one of application to this to a senior citizen the longer they've lived there, because it may have changed, but their income didn't change. And what I would suggest if we go down this route is that we allow some indexing of the real market value percentage that we allow for a senior based on the number of years in their home. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, if they have lived there, you know, the minimum years, they get the, you know, less than whatever medium property. But if they've lived there for 10 years, maybe they get, oh, there you go.
Yeah,
where's that?
That's in our notes.
It's not
thought about that.
You guys are so brilliant.
It's not included in this particular form. And the reason it's not is because we were having a discussion about what that table ought to look like, rather than that we ought to have one.
But we totally agree.
I think you need to do that, because you don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah. It needs to be some merit with it.
And the interesting thing about this, if you look at the notes on the right side of the box on number 4. Is that if you simply capped at the median, that is the numbers on this page with the two columns, if you simply capped at the median, you'd drop 4,000 people out of the current list of 11,800. But if you capped at 130% of the real market value, you could bring the program into balance by about 2016, and that includes repaying any loan, not counting the interest that we have to take out in order to make the payment. So if you think about this schedule that we're discussing this 130% as being a sort of a proxy for that, which it might be, the fact is that this program could be made viable over a period of a few years if we're careful about how we set up these sideboards. And the reason the table's not in here, as I said, is that we were trying to figure out how to set up that table in the first place with the data we have, which is pretty limited around the information that you'd need in order to make that work.
Thank you Please. For being so thoughtful on that. I would also suggest I've got some other grandfathering or stepping phase out thoughts, but if we go this way, allowing it at below median for a county seems to me very generous still. When we look, median value, median is half value.
Exactly, and that's what's listed on this other page. And we were thinking that we would limit that ones below the median would qualify. Houses above the median would only qualify depending upon how long people had been there.
Well, what my thoughts are is for initial entry into the program, allowing it simply to be below median is still generous to me. That it should be some percentage or something below median for initial entry into it. For example, simply because you're in the lower 50% of values versus the upper 50 has value on need. It doesn't give us, it's only a measurement tool. So just simply to make median your decision measurement tool there, I would suggest for initial entry that it be something below median. But the indexing can still, based on years there, can be changed. But for initial entry, I would suggest starting below median, and it may, on this indexing table, allow us an opportunity to reconcile a bit earlier at that point.
Okay, so that would be true even for somebody who lived in their house for 30 years, from your point of view.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
A little pushback there, Representative. If the purpose, what we're trying to get to is a certain need-based folks, okay? And remember, we are dealing with not just the old, but the disabled. And median income, these are not fancy houses at median income in these.
Value, not income.
Well, but income is part of our initial, we still have that initial thing that you have a house and you have income. The house is not considered part of the income, so I would suggest that this is more based on your income, not the value of your house, because what can happen is you can have turnaround and you're going to get thrown out of your house. And so if we get too strict on this house thing. The real issue is we want to keep you in your house.
Right.
So I would go more the income route than the route you're going on.
And
I'm just pushing back, and we don't have to argue about this now.
No, I don't think we are arguing, actually. When I look at some of my other thoughts that I was trying to hold off on, when I look at, you know, we've got to look at the taxpayer criteria, we have to look at property criteria, and we have to look at, to me, the risk and the state financing interplay with the counties and the taxpayer. But when I look at taxpayer criteria, big picture, we have some measurements, and we have the income measurement, the net worth measurement, the residency measurement, and then we're now throwing in the residence measurement as well in this case, and then we have to look at the taxpayer's initial certification and the recertification of the taxpayer. And I'm not suggesting that this be the only measure. I think I'm happy for this to be an element. What I'm simply saying is the median being the 50% level. Median, not average, but median, on real market value to me is to use that as the measurement of anybody below the median. I'm saying that to me still is a little bit too high of a threshold, is all for a starting point as median.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Wallant.
The discussion's fascinating. But how many people, one question then a comment, how many people use this program annually?
11,800 people, according to...
10,400.
Was that what it is?
So we have about 10,000 folks that use this, that need it, out of a couple of million people in the state. If we here trying to save the program make it so complex that it takes 25 state employees to administer it and a pound of paperwork, then we are a complete failure, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So
the more simple
we can keep this, the better off we're all going to be and the more people we're going to be able to help.
You got it.
Right. Thank you, Representative. And as we go through these ideas, one of the things to be aware of is that much of the information that you'd need in order to manage these criteria would be contained in the applications that are filed every 2 years. In other words, filled out by the homeowner or by the homeowner's representative. So, I think you're correct that we have to keep it relatively simple without too many exceptions, but that we don't have now, we'd ask for, and that's how you'd work it. Are we ready to go on to the next?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Item number 5 would be to change to a compound interest rate for any new applicants and additional property tax payments the program makes going forward. The revenue impact for this is being developed. It would increase total repayments by 6.8% per year at most. And increases in the immediate future are substantially smaller than this because there could be increases in interest outstanding, but over time it takes a while for people to pay back the interest. So the people in the program would have to move through the process, and this increase would be realized in the future. But it would not probably bring the account balance above zero in the near term.
And our thinking on this one was that if we ended up trying to present a business plan to the treasurer for the purpose of borrowing some money from some other funds, we would need to be able to demonstrate that new funds going in would actually be able to repay those accounts at the kind of rates that they're used to collecting in the market in order to do it. And that would mean that we couldn't use a simple interest rate anymore. We'd have to use a compound rate based on some reasonable market rate calculation, which we haven't determined yet. Okay, please go ahead. Another idea, the next idea.
The item 6 and 7 would be to just put a 5-year hold on new applicants, or possibly just a 1-year hold. This would bring the program's account balance up slowly, and it would raise above zero in 2014. And by 2019, the account balance would be at $50 million, but the effects eventually wear off, and the cash balance resumes a decline, dropping below zero again in 2024. But the cash fund balances under this option would remain below zero until 2014. Freezing new applications for 1 year would have another positive revenue impact, but it would not bring the account balance above zero in the near future or distant future even.
And that's assuming no other changes to the program.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's assuming we don't do the things that are on the first part of our list. In other words, simply postponing new applications doesn't solve the problem for us. You want to go ahead?
Sure. There has been also discussion of item number 8, putting a 10-year sunset on the entire program. So in 10 years, the legislature could come back and look at some of the details of the program and decide whether to extend it or not, or possibly make additional changes.
We kind of, committee members, think that one of the problems we got into is we didn't legislatively take a good look at this program
for a long time
in a timely manner, and putting a sunset on it would force future legislatures to take a look at it. That's our thinking.
Right. And you know, if we'd taken a look at it in 2009, in the way we're doing it now, we might have talked the Ways and Means Committee out of taking the money. in 2009.
You can't.
I'm looking at Representative Wand when I say that, but I don't know that that's the case, but we might have, because we could have demonstrated then that the concern that I was worried about was real, although I'm not sure you had the data at that point to prove it, because the housing bubble is the primary cause of our current difficulties, and I'm not sure it was far enough along when we were having those when we could have had those conversations 2 years ago, for you to have been able to demonstrate that. But it makes sense, doesn't it, to see how the program's doing periodically, and one of the ways for us to do that, as we've learned in dealing with other issues, is to put a sunset on things. Go ahead.
Item number 9 would be a detail to disqualify participants if they have a reverse mortgage. Currently, a senior who gets a reverse mortgage will have the outstanding deferral debt paid off by their mortgage company, and often they'll subsequently reapply for the program, and this change would be to potentially keep them from reapplying for the program after they have a reverse mortgage.
The effect of that is to do exactly what Representative Bentz was concerned about, and that is to move the priority level. The reverse mortgage pays off the senior lien, and then we'd get a new junior lien. And I think that's the point of that concern. If, of course, the other issue is that if you have sufficient equity in the house so you can afford to get a reverse mortgage, you probably can afford to get an amount that's large enough to pay the taxes in addition to the other expenses you were planning to pay with that money. Yeah, go ahead.
And item 10, currently there's a provision in the statute that individuals, if their income begins to go over this limit of $39,500, that they would have a partial property tax payment through the program. And the option would be to remove that provision, and it has a positive revenue impact for these people whose income goes above.
This is, again, you're talking about cost of administration, simplicity. You just have to have sideboards, and this seemed logical to us.
Mm-hmm. And there aren't a lot of people in it.
And there are very few affected. Let's just not go there.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, less than 100.
Yeah.
And item 11 would be to change the Oregon Project independence allocation from the revolving account. Currently, if the account balance exceeds $5 million or 35% of the total need to make the payments for the year, the additional money would be allocated over to Oregon Project Independence. So this would essentially prevent the account balance from ever going that much above zero, and would maybe possibly eliminate buffers that might be necessary to prevent shortfalls in the future.
This was recently added, wasn't it?
Yes, last time before.
Last biennial, wasn't it?
Mr. Chair, I think it was 2007, because the first transfer that this actually operated was during the 07-08 tax year, and that's when it kicked the $14 million.
All right. One of the issues for this program that many of you used to know about is that only a relatively small fraction of the people who might qualify have actually applied. Isn't that true? And if we ever got to the place where a significantly larger percentage applied, the cash flow issue would be even more critical than it is now.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that gets to part of what Representative Benz, I think, was asking earlier, was that our research department did an analysis on eligible people in Oregon based on current law, and I think they came to around 135,000 potential applicants. So we're a small percentage of what's potential.
All right. So building sideboards is really important, not having a provision that forces you to jump through hoops in order to avoid paying a different program with money that actually needs to be used for future tax payments. Okay. The last two items.
All right. Number 12 would be to potentially prorate the payments to the counties and special local taxing districts if the funds are not available. This has a positive revenue impact, at least to the program, but the account would continually be zero as long as this is taking place.
And of course, the prorate for this coming year would be very, very low, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair, we did a graph on that that showed how many, but I don't have that with me at the moment.
Yeah, I think the committee members have it because you distributed it to us the last time.
Initial year was a very low percentage of the population would be paid, and then in the second year, of course, it would greatly improved.
Yeah.
And the final provision, number 13, would be to remove the special assessment program. Currently, this program is a small subset of the main program. It has 36 active participants and distributes about $28,000 a year. So it would just be a change for simplicity with a very minimal revenue impact.
I think our thought there was to let it grandfather away, the 36 members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that we wouldn't exclude the people currently in the program, but we wouldn't add any new ones either.
Right.
That's basically to deal with what amounts to a Bancroft in those other situations. So we've got several additional comments and thoughts. I don't know if I can list them all, but the ones that I remember right off the top are the tax substitution suggestion from Representative Benz, and several suggestions concerning the real market value test from Representative Brewer. There was at least a couple of others that are escaping me, and maybe you wrote them down.
You wanted
residency limitation, medical limitation.
Right, medical leave limitation. in time, I assume, rather than.
Right, some kind of limit on time.
In addition to medical necessity designation.
Yeah, exactly. Some kind of check and balance there. I also want a definition of household also household income as we move to that. And I believe that should be discussion for both initial and recertifying, initial certification, recertification.
Yeah, our thought was that those would be the same.
There's no
step down. The reason for the current step down is administrative convenience.
Right.
That because they don't actually recertify anybody, they use the tax returns for the subsequent years, and that means that what they had to go on mm-hmm. was the adjusted gross income measure.
I have some other thoughts. May I?
Please. Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, first off, as we talked about, the tax return is very not meaningful when it comes to seniors' income. And, for example, adjusted gross income excludes for most seniors that would be qualifying all their Social Security benefits. Also, seniors, they may they may have a portfolio because they're in Oregon of heavy municipal interest, things like that, conservative investments, interest throwing off, non-taxable income. They may have wealth that does not throw off income with their estate planning and so on and so forth. Income on the tax return is meaningless when it comes to qualifying for this, particularly in that age group.
Now, would that be covered by the asset test?
That's why I think blending both an income criteria test and an asset test makes sense. Again, because, you know, there's great discretion on your net worth of turning it into cash or income,
mm-hmm.
and you know, not having income doesn't mean you don't have the ability to pay your wealth. And this program, the policy is to keep people in their homes that need help. It is not to be an additional benefit for citizens that don't need it. And so I think keeping that in mind, that's why I like the asset test. And to me, $500,000 again is quite generous, particularly because it excludes the dwelling unit as proposed in that other state.
So you would suggest a lower amount?
If you're going to go up around $500,000, I would also think that you would need to include the dwelling. You know, so somewhere in there's a happiness. Something that makes sense to me when I look at the profile of our seniors.
Let me just inquire. I'm guessing, but I'd like your thoughts based on you're looking at the files over time. I'm guessing that a large percentage of the people on our program are people whose income is pretty limited, and whose assets, other than their house, is pretty limited.
I would imagine.
Is that a reasonable assumption on my part or not?
Mr. Chair, we don't have anything on their assets, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
But for income, a typical income for a program participant is in the high teens to low $20,000 a year.
FAGI.
Correct.
FAGI.
Of AGI.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you threw in Social Security, some of them might not qualify.
Possibly.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. And then just some other conceptual thoughts. It's escaping me. We have worked on a program where counties opt in on low-income housing.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm wondering, when I look at this, the state carries the full risk of this, the financial risk of it, and particularly when we're talking about compounding interest and such so that the treasurer can go out and securitize. We have subordinate liens, as Representative Bentz talked about, and so our ability to collect is at risk. And we have a very odd market going on right now with home values, which gets to the real market value testing as well. So having the different criteria makes sense to me. But I'm wondering if we somehow are able. I know this is crazy, and I don't have an answer. But is there some way to share the risk between the states and the counties? That counties just as low income, this is kind of the same type of goal we're trying to achieve. If counties opt in into this program somehow, it's not unilaterally applied across the state, but each county looking at their own population. Like, for example, one of the cities in my district has a tremendously high senior citizen population. So Washington County, you know, may want to opt in. Some other counties may not, but opting in and then somehow sharing the financial risk of this might make sense. And I don't mean to shift money problems to the counties, but allowing some management of this to happen and looking more comprehensively at this because we don't have all the dollars. The other thing is that on this, because we do have limited dollars and we aren't able to fund it, I've heard the word grandfathering, which I like, but rather than stepping a phase out of the program, except for sunsetting and revisiting, maybe a stepping down of benefits. So because we can't afford it, if by moving to this different measurement, we make the measurement criteria is relevant, but we also start to manage the outcome and we grandfather new participants into it in a stepping down of programs or stepping down of benefits.
Okay. Other thoughts, and there may be a couple of ideas that we haven't captured that people mentioned earlier. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was interested in item 4. and go back to that conversation just
yeah.
for a moment. And it seemed to me it was a limiting, the one point where the group obviously needed to find something to limit the program, mm-hmm. and this is it. The link, and I think Co-Chair Berger commented on it, between the reality of how well off a person is in that particular house seems to be the more proper point of reference, but your real goal was to limit the program. So I just ask, is this the only way we can choose to limit the program? Is it the most efficient way of affecting the result, which is to limit the program?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what's really going on. It doesn't really have much to do with the financial ability of the person inside the house.
Well, you know, I think that's a very interesting kind of question, because I think there's an interaction. If you're talking about someone who bought a house 5 years ago, so they now qualify for the program under this rule, and therefore they've got a big mortgage and they're paying off their mortgage. I don't know how you do that with $39,500 worth of income, but let's suppose you figured out a way to do that. And you have an expensive house. Then the question I would have is, have you been providently using your resources in a way that ought to allow you to get involved in the program? Take the same house with a couple have been there for 30 years. They don't have a mortgage or a very low mortgage, and not much income. They're the ones that the program was really intended to benefit in the first place, for all the reasons we've already talked about. So there is that interaction. The other piece, of course, is that simply adding the asset test and actually enforcing the income test, which we haven't really been doing lately, also significantly limits the program, it seems to me. And of course, we don't have the data to know exactly how much it would limit the program. If we only have the adjusted gross income for most of the participants at this point, we don't know if somebody who reports a $19,000 adjusted gross income actually qualifies for the program under the $39,500 test, because they may have income that doesn't show up on their tax return. So, I mean, all those things interact with each other. And part of our problem is, and of course, you complain about this in other contexts all the time, that we have to make a decision in a partial vacuum of information because we simply don't have the data. And the chances of being wrong are significant in terms of what kind of policy we're trying to pursue.
I think in all of the hypotheticals you suggested, the element of equity came into play,
yeah.
comes into play, and so a focus on equity in the home might be of interest, but the net result of this in the second hypothetical you used is that the folks will have to sell their house.
Yes.
And that's why I go back to this and say, well, I think it's a limiting device. I'm just going to set that aside because for all the reasons you mentioned, it's a challenging issue. The other one that's came up in some of the discussion is the question of why we're using a lower interest rate. Indeed, the state is going to be taking the risk. Why are we reducing the interest rate?
Because I'm not sure we are.
That's a decision.
We haven't gotten there yet.
No. The comparison interest rate is 16%. Comparable rate is 16%.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You're talking about the rate for the property tax payment issue.
Exactly. And so what I'm saying is, if we're going to be taking this risk, mm-hmm. which we are, then why is the rate reduced from the default position of 16% or 9%? What is the policy element in that discussion? And we need to be kicking around and say to ourselves, okay, we're going to be giving a person a deferral. Should we also add to it a lower interest rate?
Let me ask a question in response to your question. Is the judgment rate now 9% compounded? Is that the way it works, or is it 9% simple?
I think it's simple.
It's 9% simple interest.
9%
per annum.
Okay.
For the committee, this has been very helpful to us.
Yeah.
So you know where how we got here. It was in the way this is laid out the way it is, we didn't know the answers to these questions when we asked them. What's going to constrain the program when you start with, here's our goal? So, like some of these, you say, well, what a dumb question. Well, we didn't know the answer when we asked the question. So we got some of these on the tail end seem like no-brainers, or they don't have an impact. What surprised me was what did have an impact and what didn't. Mm-hmm. And if we're trying to save the program, that's a fundamental thing we need to put on the table. And if we can't, then that's another discussion. And when it's done, what will it look like? I think that it's very telling that they just said 130,000 some people would qualify this for this program right now, but only 10,400 are doing it. And I believe that the vast majority of those 10,400 people really need this program.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are, I know, people who are abusing this. There's a few. And some of them are getting away with it because we weren't watching closely enough. And that's one of the things we need to do here. But I think for the vast majority of people in this program, when you look at their house value alone, you say, oh, my goodness, who's living in a house with a $19,000 value on it, real market value? This is not high living. Mm-hmm. And there are those in this program.
And you know, I think the answer, Representative Benz, to your question about the regular rate on delinquent taxes, that rate, at least as I think about it, that 16% is at least in the current economic situation pretty punitive, and the object of it is to get people to pay up quickly. I mean, it's second only to your credit cards in terms of the interest rate at that point. And so it's going to be pretty, if you're rational about paying your debts, that would be fairly high on the list of things to get paid, aside from the fact, of course, that eventually you lose the house if you don't pay it. The object of this program is not to do that. The object of this program is to provide a maintenance for people in economic circumstances who need it. With the understanding that the rate is reasonable, and that it gets and somewhat of a disincentive, and that the whole thing gets paid back later. So the theory of why you would charge a particular interest rate, I think, is different than the scoffer who simply didn't pay his taxes.
I mean, Of course, the reason we have that punitive rate is because of the importance of the uses that
yes.
we spend the money on.
Right.
Thus, that puts in perspective maybe the value of that which we're giving away by allowing the deferral. We could go around and around, I'm guessing.
Well, but this is why we wanted to have this conversation, is to get the different points of view of the committee members, and I think we've gotten a bunch of them. A couple of members haven't made any comments at all, and if you have any, please, Representative Wand first, and then...
Yeah, just a quick drive-by on this issue, which is that it is very difficult when you do not have income and when you're retired and you're not actively working to get any kind of a mortgage. And so we are providing a tremendous benefit to these folks who really need it. And I don't know, I think I'm agreeing somewhat with Representative Benz here, which is to say that I don't know that the market mortgage rate or even a slightly higher than market mortgage rate ought to be a benchmark on the interest that we are seeking for this tremendous benefit that we're offering to people who really need it, that is a lot easier and a lot less burdensome than a mortgage.
Right. And when I was initially thinking about the mortgage or the interest issue, I was thinking about the practical problem of repaying a loan that we might get from some fund in the Treasury. Given that it is possible that such a loan might be paid off in just a few years, mm-hmm. it may be that we don't need to spend as much time on that issue as I was originally thinking.
Gotcha.
And I was throwing in a different issue, which is how do we repay the note if we borrow money for this? Now, what I prefer to do, frankly, getting back to our conversation earlier, Representative Wand, is to make some other important changes in our tax law to recover funds and use some of that money to fund this program this year. And if in fact the cash flow issues are as the department suggests, the number of dollars involved in that is smaller than I had originally thought. But of course, that's a decision that the committee and the House and the Senate will have to make later, and may be wrapped up in budgetary decisions and not easy decisions, I think, for any of the members. On the other hand, they may be involved in funding some of the other programs that also help our senior citizens stay in their homes, like OPI itself, and perhaps some of the other things that we do. So that's a stay tuned kind of comment. But I think I didn't want to go out of this hearing without mentioning that as one of the possibilities. And of course, what I'm referring to is the senior medical deduction, which tends to benefit wealthy people at a much higher amount than low-income people. When the purpose of this program, is, of course, is to benefit low-income people who happen to be fortunate enough to own a house. Okay. Any other comments on this now? Yeah, Representative Bennett.
Just to make sure the record is clear, I'm not recommending the 16%.
Oh, no. Thank you. That does help us if we think about this. So I'll take you off the list of Representative Bentz as a no unless the interest rate is 16%. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Other comments? I'm not at all sure we're done with this issue.
No.
We may very well have at least, we're certainly going to have at least one more conversation on it. But I think this is helpful. Representative Berger, you agree?
I totally. Yeah. This was incredibly helpful. We have, as you can see, reached a point where we need more conversation to finish where we're going on this, and appreciate your attention and your thoughts, and you can certainly continue to think about this.
Great.
We haven't written anything up yet, and we're still gathering data on these things.
Yeah, and we appreciate the assistance of the assessor from Multnomah County.
Who was here to answer questions.
Sitting in the back patiently to answer questions, who has been very helpful in helping us gather information, and we expect we'll get some more from him as we go along. Of course, the department, AARP, and others who have been involved in our conversation, and I hope we'll continue to be. Anything else then this morning? All right, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2543. 8:30 tomorrow morning, this committee will not be meeting, but you're all going to be here for the Tax Credit Committee. With that, we're adjourned.